Okay, I guess we're there to start. Welcome again. The topics today will be some of the central or some central terminology, some requirements for good reach, and some of these terms that we are going to touch upon today, they are also the terms that we ask about in the first assignment that you are supposed to deliver in, I don't know how many days it is, 14 days time or something around that. I think it's the 3rd of October. I'll come back to that in the end of this lecture. One thing that I always forget to do in the first thing, and you've maybe been confronted with this in other courses as well, as part of the quality insurance system we have at NTNU, we are supposed to have a reference group in the course, a reference group that's supposed to be the contact between me and the rest of the students. But that also should try to summarize things up in the end, how things have gone in the course. So the idea is that we need 3 volunteers for this. It's not a big job. And some of you may have in other classes as well. It will be a nice thing if you will come from different studies. Programs, for instance, so that's a plus. Anyone who volunteers right away, or you can come to me in the break, and then I'll try to remember to put a bit more pressure on your break. Okay, think about it. It's not a big thing. It's a good thing to have someone in this role, and it's good to be in that role for many of you. It's a good experience. We started to talk about this last time as well. So one of the basic requirements to do any research whatsoever is to have something to do research on, not just a broad topic, but a question that you want to answer. And this is also the definition of what we usually refer to as research problem or research question. It should be a sentence that at some point asks a question. Does watching videos with violent content lead to more violent kids or whatever? That's just an example of such a question that might be answered directly, or that might need further refinement, as you maybe need to break it down in smaller and smaller and smaller parts. There are some criteria set up for what we say is a good research problem to do actual research on. And one of these minimum requirements is that something about the relationship between variables. Something should have an influence on something else. And I'll get back to what we mean by variables and how we define variables, because variables comes in different flavors. We have dependent variables, we have independent variables, we have or confounding variables that might influence the situation. And the research question, the research problem we have should have this type of, it should say something about variables that have some connection. So in my example, for instance, you could say that we lead out a hypothesis, an a priori hypothesis, saying that yes, we believe that watching more violent content in a video game leads to more violent kids. So the independent variable, seeing a lot of content, leads to something, and that's the dependent variable, more violence or more aggression or whatever. We'll get back to this example a few times. As we mentioned, it should be stated in a question-like form, so it should be possible to formulate it as some kind of a question. And then comes a bit of a challenging part, because in pure empirical quantitative research, we all say that it should be testable. So it should be possible to test the relationship talk about between the variables. I put this in Klamme. I put it, it's not natural, because there are research who also are a lot more exploratory in its nature. And of course, then things can't be formulated in this way. So depending on the type of problem you have, this might not be true. You should still be able to say something about relationship of variables. You should still be it should still be possible to ask this problem in a question form. But it might be more exploratory. You might try to investigate things in order to test things out later. And as I said, usually the research problems we come up with needs to be decomposed first. And that's an exercise in itself. In the textbook here, there are a few examples of techniques you can use to try to decompose and cut down the initial research question into sub-questions, which usually is a good exercise, and which usually is what you need to do. I'll just skip this then. So how do I come up with research questions? Well, some of it can be pretty straightforward, right? It can be based on something you observe. A lot of the research in natural sciences, for instance, is based on this. You see something in nature that you try to explain, and that raises some questions, and that sets you in a position to try to investigate. It might be something that happens in society. In my field, psychology, we have a lot of research that comes from trying to follow up on societal problems in different forms, things that has happened that we try to explain. For instance, there is a case there was a girl being killed. She was called Kitty Genovese. I think it was an American thing in the 60s sometime. She was attacked outside a large building, several hundred residents there. She was, I think there was two or three attackers. I'm not sure if they raped her and what happened there, but in the end she died. Some 200 spectators. Nobody called the police. Nobody did anything to help her. It raised, of course, a lot of debate in newspapers. How has this society developed into such a cold society where nobody helps? But it also raised a huge number of research projects to try to explain what had happened here. A lot of more laboratory experiments were set up, where people were set together and where the researchers played out different emergency scenarios. And by doing this, they could manipulate and investigate under what circumstances do people help, and under what circumstances are they withdrawing or putting responsibility to somebody else or whatever happens. So based on this, we know a lot of this today. We know that huge crowds are more likely than small crowds to do this. We know that people who know each other are less likely, are more likely to help than people who don't know each other. We know that people from that are defined to be in the same group as you are more likely to help, and so on. And that was an example of something that happened in society and that triggered a lot of research. There weren't much theory on this before this happened. So this is a good inspiration. So when you see something within your field, for instance, that seems to be explainable or whatever, that needs to be further investigated, that might be a good starting point for good research. The next step, and the more common one, is inspired by research literature in different forms. You've probably been pushed a little bit towards that side in bachelor's program as well. Investigate not only Googling stuff, but actually using the big and nice databases that we have available in the academic society, where you can, based on initial keywords that you come up with, investigate and follow threads backwards, forwards, find important research, find the big debates. So there's a lot of stuff to be found there. There is also, we can mention that, a very good idea to, when you find something interesting in literature, when you find an article, a review article or whatever, a research thing that you found interesting and that you would like to follow up on, these usually have a chapter in the end somewhere that says something about further research. Things that this paper hasn't really investigated, hasn't been able to investigate, based on their choice methodologies, based on their uncertainties in their findings, for instance. And that's a direct way into very nice further research. And in ideas to do. What you also, of course, which is obvious, is to talk with people who, within your area, have knowledge, are to be considered as experts. Talk to your teachers, who all of them are doing research in different ways. Who have ideas about topics they are interested in and would like to follow up on. So that's a good line. That may be the most used line, and that's what a lot of you will do in the end. You end up with a supervisor and try to do something that's within the supervisor's interest area. And you choose actually a supervisor based on a general idea of what you're interested in. Conferences is a good idea. Fortunately, a lot of them costs money, but students usually have very cheap access, and most conferences today, after 2-3 years of COVID, also are streaming their conferences, so online participation possibilities, which are really cheap for students. There are conferences here at NTNU. Here in Gjøvik, I know there has been one now in color science, for instance, for those of you who do that, which is a good, the reason conferences are really good is that there is a lot of work in progress being presented there. So you could say that the new strains of research interests, they usually come up in conferences before they come out in paper form, for instance. So And it also gives you contacts, a possibility to ask people about this. So a good idea for finding a question. But do something that, and this is the more, say the more back to or down to ground of this. A lot of the a lot of strain on master students and a lot of delays, procrastination that you end up doing in your master thesis tends to be because you're not really that motivated or not really that interested in the topic that you follow up on. So finding a topic that you are really interested in maybe trumps every other reason or idea or inspiration. So try to do something that you're motivated to do, and then it's probably possible to tweak it into the direction that's also academically interesting. Let me just take the last one, be realistic. And that's also part of this. A lot of master thesis tends to stop being a bit too ambitious, trying to solve big problems. No more climate crisis, no more. A lot more helping behavior. A lot warmer society, errors of applications, never happens. So be realistic. Think, make a small contribution. Probably won't be able to do the big one anyway. Now, one of the first definitions today. What are the variables that we are dealing with? And we'll come to these two first ones. We are always dealing with an independent and a dependent variable. The independent variable is the thing that we put into the situation or that exists out there. But it's the thing that we wonder whether has a consequence for something else. And this is one of the things that you will or are asked to find in the first assignment that you're given. You're going to write a short paper, and one of the topics you are to do there is to identify the independent and the dependent variable that are in two different academic papers or academic papers in exclamation marks. They're not necessarily that's academic, none of them, any of them. But they have independent and dependent variables. And of course, the dependent variable is the thing that changes. And then we have other types of variables as well, and that's what we tend to call mediating and moderating variables, or often also referred to as confounding variables or referred to as third variables. And those are other factors that have effect on the situation. And we'll do a few exercises where we will try some of these out. But a very key thing which is necessary when we are dealing with variables and when we are going to do actual research where we are playing around with variables is the fact that now and then, or we need to be very precise when it comes to defining what we mean by a variable. Because the question that we ask, and this is a this could be a research question. There were some Olympic Games here in Lillehammer from, when was it, 94, I think, 1994. And we could ask a question like this. Did Lillehammer, the Olympics in Lillehammer, did that make people in this region more happy? Right, it's a pretty straightforward question. But where you have a dependent variable before and after the Olympics, and you have a dependent variable which is happy, seems okay, right? It's not necessarily that straightforward. Because there are some terms here, right, that may be a bit difficult. One of them is pretty obvious. What's the independent variable? How can we define that? I have already defined it. Let's skip it. Before and after. But what's the dependent one? Is that as straightforward? Yes? The people aren't the dependent. It's happiness. It's people's happiness that's the dependent. But the problem here comes with a term like happiness. What do we mean by happiness? Different researchers might have very different interpretations of a term like this. What is happiness? How can we define that? It can be many, many things. Any suggestions? We tend to end up with something like as measured on the, and then comes some name, a fancy name of a tool, a questionnaire for measuring general happiness or something like that. Walden's tool for measuring happiness, which may be a questionnaire or which may be something else. Maybe it's some psychophysical measurement that you take. Not sure, some electrodes you put somewhere. Or it could be something completely different, because I know that somebody did something like this. They defined happiness as the number of smiles on a given given Saturday in the main street in Lillehammer. Right? So they measured the percentage of smiles. It could be, I'm not sure if it's a good one, but at least These all require very different approaches, right? One is observation. You just count smiles. That's one method to use. First one I suggested requires something else, a sample of a nice representative sample and the use of questionnaire in a standardized form. The psychophysical one probably means that you need to put people in a laboratory after the Olympics. It needed to be well planned, so I'm not sure if it's a good one. But anyway, it's these different operationalizations or formulations of what we mean by a term also put very... It gives us a direction, a very strong direction for the methodologies that we choose. And some definitions are better suited within some research or some professional arenas, academic areas, better suited than others. So some of you will read algorithms and testing out algorithms, for instance. Some will do more people-related work. Some will do observations in nature. Some will work with simulations, whatever. But the operationalizations should also fit the professional fields that you're doing this research in. We can try out a few. I'll give you a few minutes to think about this one. The stuff you see on the site is actually out there. There are some signs you can find along roads. And it was at some point an attitude campaign to reduce speeding. Try to reduce speed. And I'm not sure if it helps or not. This could be a pretty straightforward thing, right? Does a specific attitude campaign, does this attitude campaign over the speed limit, does it reduce speeding on the highway, on highways? What would be the independent and the dependent in this case? But we can take one that's a bit more complicated alongside this one. We can try one that says that meditation makes us into better humans. Does meditation make us better humans? Would then be the research question, right? In the very topmost level. Use a few minutes now. I'll give you 2-3 minutes to discuss with your friends here or neighbors here. Try to answer these two. Find the variables and try out different operationalizations of the terms that are mentioned here. Okay, should we try it? The first one. What would the independent and dependent variables be? First one first. Yeah. Yes. The campaign is independent. That's what we check out the effect of, and we check if that has an effect on speeding. But then comes the problem. That's the independent variable. So that's the one we put into the equation. We want to see if that has an effect on speeding. That's why it's independent. So it's independent in the meaning it isn't depending on anything else. It's independent because it has an effect on something else. Yeah. That you pinpointed one of the problems here that a lot of you will face. It seems like a pretty easy thing, this, to define independent and dependent variables, but a lot of people make or confuse it with the normal language meaning of being independent. It doesn't have anything to do with that. Yeah. No, but the attitude campaign here is dependent, and the speeding is dependent. But now comes the challenge, of course, that is the reason for putting this up. And that's the operationalization. Is that an easy one here? One of them is easy. The independent is easy because that's mentioned already. It's the campaign, right? And usually before and after the campaign, or where the campaign is and where it isn't, or something like that. So of course these two are different, but those are easy to describe. So either to do this before and after a campaign, or maybe you want to do it on different roads, maybe, I'm not sure, where the campaign is launched and where it isn't launched or whatever. So that's the independent variable. Of course that needs operationalization as well, as we did now, but it's pretty easy. But of course, the other one might be a bit challenging here. And that's usually the case. It's the dependent variable that is the challenge. So any suggestions? How can we operationalize that one? And operationalize here means put into operation, more something measurable. Something that we actually can put into the and use as a method. Yeah. Number of speeding instances in a given time period, for instance, something like that. But it could be something else. You could define it as accidents if you were took it a bit further. It could be fines. It could be number of speeding incidents above a certain level. It could be mean speed. So there are a number of possibilities. Anyway, this one is pretty straightforward. I'll get back to it because there are other things that's difficult with a research question like that. But the other one then. What's the independent and dependent? Does meditation make us into better humans? It's probably called mindfulness now. Right? This is an old-fashioned word, meditation. Nobody meditates anymore. Meditation is the independent. Usually, it also helps us that it come in this order. The independent usually is stated before the dependent in a sentence like this. So meditation is the independent and better humans is the dependent. Is it researchable the way it's formulated now? Can you do research on it? Not at all. It's help you. What do we mean by meditation? Could be a lot of things. Is viewing an aquarium for 10 minutes meditation? Is Aika meditation or specific techniques, mindfulness as taught by somebody, is that meditation? It's up to us to decide, right? But we need to state what we have put into this in order for others to be able to question our approach. So we need to define this much better. What is meant by meditation in this context? So even the independent variable in this context is difficult. And this is also something you will encounter a lot when you do, when you read especially popularized versions of research. You will find these high-level questions and only the high-level questions and not the operations. When people say that watching TV makes your eyesight worse or something like that, I'm not sure if that comes out here and there, but yes, it probably has been. That's usually not what the scientists actually said in their paper. They probably had some specifications. They said what they meant by, in this case, meditation. They said what they meant by better humans. What could a better human be? One that's likely to help others? I'm not sure. Earns more money? It's probably not a good one. You could define it as that. Yeah. But you have to, if you are going to do research on this, you have to define it in some way. Maybe there are usually a lot of questionnaires and inventories up for these things to measure state and trait happiness. There are national indicators of state happiness that measures objectively things like this, but then you have to specify what you are putting into this. How do you measure? How do you want to measure being a better human? Being less aggressive? Succeeding with more goals? Being more likely to help others? Avoid cheating in exams, I'm not sure. And it could be a combination of these, but you need to say them. You need to state them. And good idea also to be critical when you do this and read others' work in accordance to this. Do you agree with that these researchers actually have made? And that can also be an inspiration for further research. If you don't agree with the research's original operationalization, the way they have measured, for instance, happiness or better humans or speeding, then you can challenge it by applying an operationalization that might shed another light on the same stuff. It's also a way to be able to raise your own research questions in a better way. Usually we try to state, and this is, we're now touching, moving over more to the other variables that's involved here. Because one of the basic ideas that we put up here is that there should be a relationship between an independent and a dependent variable. And we want to say that there should be a causal explanation that actually it's changes in the independent variable that causes the observed changes in the dependent variable. That's a cause-effect relationship. That's what we want to find out, because that is what we ask about in the research question that is initially. And there are a couple of necessary things to be in place in order for us to say that there is a causal explanation available to us. We should be able to describe it without alternative explanations available. We should be able to say that things covariate in a way that when one change, the other also change, and that this change is in a correct time order relationship, that one thing occurs before the other. And we do this in ideally in a experimental setting or in a test setting where we have some formal line we want to control. We set up some, just the example of we could do that before the take a break. We used this, we had this campaign up here. This one. So let's say we do the first one. Let's say we have, we are set a very nice type of experiment here. We set up some automatic things to control speed, and we say that what we mean by speeding is the number, the ratio of cars that that drives more than 10 kilometers an hour above the speed limit. So the ratio of people who do that compared to those who don't. That's the optionalization we make here. And we have automatic control. We do this before we launch the campaign. We do it afterwards. So we try to put up a relationship. We set up a test. We have a test one, which is the baseline measurement. We launch the campaign, which is what we ideally would like to do. And then we measure speeding again afterwards. And as we are good researchers and we make a good report here. No, that's a bad comment. We measure differences. Right? The ratio of cars driving too fast after launching the campaign is lower than it was before, and it is statistically significant lower. We'll get back to these terms later. So we can say that numerically we have an effect here. And we are, of course, happy, and we sell this to the company that launched the campaign and say that, yes, this was a very successful campaign. But is it necessarily so? Are there threats to the conclusion we came up with here? We observed something, but could there be mistakes in the observations we made? Okay, 15 minutes break, and we will think about this in the break. What other things we can question about the conclusion we sell from this research? And then we touch the term variables or confounding variables, which is what we need to think about here. So 15 minutes break. Thank you. Now it's on. Sorry. It's a good idea to come here and not listen to the stream anyway. I have heard that, by the way, I've been notified that the streaming from the room is a bit laggy again. I'm not sure what to do with it. I'll check with IT tomorrow. I'm just setting up this in beforehand on the net, so I don't do any settings really. But I'll check it. You'll listen to this and see the recording. Hopefully the recording is better than the streaming, but I'm not sure. Yeah, regression effects, the fact that there is a higher risk for individual observation to be extreme than for many observations, and then for the following observation to be extreme. They tend to fall in towards the center. And there are things we can do against all of this. We can choose methodologies that don't allow for history changes, meaning that we measure the same thing maybe at the same point in time. If we have two comparison roads, for instance, and we launch the campaign in one and not in the other, maybe that's helpful. To take care of changes in measurement, the measurement instrument, we can add redundancy by measuring things in different ways, or by having multiple measures of the same thing. So these are ways to address it, and a very common thing to do when you are doing research that is humans is to add types of control groups. Some get the treatments and some doesn't get the treatment, and everything else is the same. So those are strategies to avoid these threats to causality, and allows us to take control of them, to say that there actually is a cause-effect relationship between an independent and a dependent variable. So there are other threats to causality as well. And one of them is that we shouldn't mix up correlation with causality. The fact that two things seem to vary in the same way does not necessarily mean that one causes the other. And it's a sport out there to find these kinds of spurious or funny correlations. A very popular one is the first one. There seems to be a relationship between ice cream eating and shark attacks. Maybe sharks like ice cream, I don't know. That could be the newspaper headline, if you find a relationship like this, right? Girt length and stock prices are highly correlated. You can find that on this link here. The second one is probably a bit hard to explain. I'm not sure. The first one is probably easy to explain. What would it be? Ice cream sales and number of shark attacks on swimmers are correlated. It's of course because people swim only when it's warm and they eat swim only when it's warm. But if you follow, you can search on the net for spurious correlations, and you find a couple of sites that have lots of these types of statistics, where you find nice curves that shows these types of relationships, and they happen now and then. So we need to be sure that there isn't something else that causes this. So this is the first one we have, is the correlation problem. But there is another one, maybe even more challenging to deal with, and that's what we tend to call the direction problem. And this... what's up there now is something that Scandinavians probably know what it is. It's Holbergs Jeppe på Bjerge. It's a text from, I think, 1800 something, where Jeppe says, or where, who is it? What's the name of Jeppe's mother? I think she says something like, why are you drinking so much, Jeppe? Your life will become so miserable because you drink so much. You live such an irresponsible life. Well, I drink because life is terrible, he says. So what's the relationship? What's the right way to see this? Right? There is an interpretation here. And that's something we need to take into account now and then when we also interpret and plan research and interpret our own findings. What leads to what? And then one example of such a debate is a very common debate that's been in psychology and media sciences and for computer scientists, I guess. And that's one that occurs now and then that comes back and back and back in different versions. I think it was there when, it was probably there when books were commonly available. It definitely was there when TV came around. It was there when computer games was popular. And it even raised one level when online games was more common. And that's the saying that video violence, violent video games leads to more violence among kids. And there were some findings that indicated this in the early days that raised this debate. There was an observation that kids who were home looking a lot on TV when they came back from school showed more aggressive tendencies than those who watched less TV or less violent TV. And this has been documented on several other occasions later as well. But it's also been questioned in different ways. Alternative explanation of this observation. Have you heard this debate? I'm quite sure you met this debate now and then. Is it true? Does violence lead to more violent kids or more aggression among kids? We think so. There is an observation. Some don't think so. The gamers don't think so. So it's, well, that was a bit stereotypical, but there is an alternative explanation of the finding. What could that be? Any suggestions? We observe a relationship, there is a correlation here. There is also, you could say, a cause-effect, maybe. Some one leads to the other. We have observed that, we did that. But there is an obvious alternative explanation that came up quite early here, and that is the other way around. Maybe it's kids who are a bit more aggressive, who look a lot on aggressive programs on TV and play aggressive games and play violent games. So maybe it's kind of a self-recruitment thing. And that's the same as Jeppe på Bjerge here says. There is a problem here. And of course, this has been tested out in different. You can test it out in more experimental ways, giving people the time of actually doing or looking at TV, and then they should express, try out another test that's the dependent variable later. So it can be controlled. And I think that the general thing to short make this story a bit shorter is to say that there seems to be a relationship between playing violent games and showing more aggression, but it's only for the few. It's only for those who are vulnerable. So there is a vulnerability, a third factor involved here, and that's a personal, a personality thing. It could be something like that. At least family environment is, of course, one possibility that creates this vulnerability. So there are other possible explanations here. So for most people, they can play as much violent games as they like without having any effects, without that affecting their aggression level. But for a few, it's negative. So that's the general conclusion on these things now. But it raises the challenges, the easy relationship between cause and effect here. Now and then we have a direction problem. I have another example of something comparable when we do these types of correlational research. This is based on, we were testing out a tool for measuring sensation seeking. It's a personality thing. We are different in with respect to how eager we are to enter new situations, to want to climb high mountains, to want to see people driving cars fast, drive cars fast ourselves. We are different with respect to these things. Some want to see scary movies, some don't. Some want stability, some want change. So there are a few tools for this, and we tested out a tool in a big study among youths here in Innlandet, where 15,000 15-year-olds involved in the study. It's a huge one. It hasn't anything to do with what we did. This is just an add-on, what we put on there, just to test out this questionnaire that's called AISS, our net system for sensation seeking. And when we applied that, we saw, it wasn't only 15-year-olds, it was a huge population. It was a general census, is what they call it. Folkehelseundersøkelse på norsk. So we showed a strong relationship between sensation seeking there, because we wanted to test out what does it define. What's the combination? Is there a strong link between scoring high as a sensation seeker and having different types of illnesses or getting into risk situations in society? We tested it against a lot of other factors, and we found a very strong relationship between sensation seeking and questions that had to do with sexual habits, for instance. I'm hoping I don't offend anyone here. But we also have a very strong relationship between sensation and age. The older we get, the lower we tend to score sensation seeking. And we have relationships between age and sexual habits. So how do we interpret this finding? Can we say that there is a relationship between sensation-seeking and these sexual habits here? Or is there something else that's much, much more important, and this is just a very minor relationship? It's probably age that's the major factor. And third factors might affect, you could say, a cause-effect relationship in different ways. X is here the independent variable, and Y is the dependent variable. So in a very, you could say, controlled setting, this third factor, the C set here, is totally irrelevant for the effect that we are observing. And that's, of course, ideal when we want to establish this cause-effect relationship. But we also have instances where it's both of them are affecting the dependent. We have causes where set need to be there in order for a relationship to occur. It doesn't happen before that one happens. It could be an in-between thing. It could be something that lies behind both of them. And then the relationship we observe is a purely spurious one, like the sharks and the ice cream. Because it's weather that's actually the effect, and that affects both of them. So there are a lot of threats to causality, and we fall into these pits a lot. Most of us do. Mistakes on these things. What we do to avoid it? We can do different things. We can at least what we need to do to take control here is to record and analyze potential other variables involved. The example I gave on this big census study, where we saw the relationship between our tool and some other variables, we of course also measured the third variables in different ways. We measured age. That's good. We have variable age in here. What we could do in the speed campaign is. Avoid this, the effect of weather, for instance, is to measure weather and control for that. By putting it into the equation, we can statistically control for these factors. We can calculate what effects they have on both variables and to what degree is it an intermediate variable. That's one strategy. We measure all the alternative variables. But in order to do that, of course, what we need to do is to identify them so we actually measure them. So that's a methodological thing. We need to identify the potential third variables. In many types of questionnaires, for instance, survey studies we apply, we know about a few of these external factors. We know that socioeconomic factors are important. Your level of education, your age, where you live, where you come from. Know that some of these factors tend to have an important meaning, and then we need to measure them, and then we know that we have to measure them. But another strategy is, of course, to isolate these effects, perform extremely controlled experiment where you take out all these other explanations. Make comparable groups. If you have two groups that are exactly the same, where people come from the same population, they have the same age, gender distribution, then we can take this out of the equation. So that's another strategy. But it all comes to the need to identify things and apply a structured and well-planned data collection. Now, a couple of more terms before we take the group work and that stuff, because this is also something I ask about in the first element, and that is the terms reliability and validity. In Norwegian, we have other we have good words for it as well. Stabilitet og gyldighet. That may be helpful for those who speak Norwegian. So there could be English words as well that are synonyms to this. But reliability is the extent to which a measurement is consistent. So maybe you could say consistency or something. In a car, a speedometer that gives you the same speed every time you drive in a speed is reliable. If it always shows the same number when you drive in a certain speed. Not necessarily the right one, because that has to do with validity. So, and validity means then to the extent to which a concept, conclusion, or measurement is well-funded and corresponds to the real world, that actually measures what it should measure. So when it comes to the speedometer, a valid speedometer shows you the number 80 when you drive in 80. But it can be reliable even if it shows you 72 every time you drive 80. Because it does this every time. Then you have a reliable instrument. So what we tend to say is that reliability is a prerequisite for us in validity. There are strategies you can compensate a little bit for. Let's say you shoot at a target here then, and let's have poor reliability, but it's still valid. It just measures different things. It gives you different numbers, but there is around the right number. You can compensate a bit by having a number of observations. That's a strategy to avoid situations like that. But in general, you need a reliable instrument. You can have fewer observations and you can be more certain about what you observe when you have a reliable instrument. Then comes a lot of discussions when it comes to validity afterwards. And I'll mention one type of discussion because I think this is an important discussion when it comes to the task that you're going to perform, the first day. Because in those articles, it's probably necessary to define what we call internal or discuss internal and external validity, because these are two forms of validity when you do studies. You can have high internal validity, and that means that you actually have shown a good and valid relationship between cause and effect, between an independent and a dependent variable in an experimental setting or in a study setting. There is a good relationship shown there, and that is consistent. It can be repeated within the same type of study, same type of experiment. Then you have high internal validity. There is a correct relationship here. But it's not necessarily externally valid. Maybe it's something that only occurs in the experimental setting you have created. And maybe it doesn't work in the real world. Maybe it doesn't generalize to other cases, to other places, times. And that's something we usually want to try to accomplish. We try to achieve some level of generalizability. Generalizability is what we talk about when we talk about external validity compared to internal validity. So let me just jump on to the first assignment here. Third of October is the date I'm here. Let's try to follow that date. Is there another date somewhere? Probably. It says the 1st of October. Then we do use the 3rd. I'll change it in Blackboard to the 3rd. Okay? This always sorry. So this is the date that goes. I'll change it in Blackboard as well, and I'll make a delivery folder tomorrow for this. What day is it? It's a Monday? No. That's a Monday? Isn't that good? Yeah? Okay. By the end of the day, the 3rd of October, you should deliver this. And the task is to read two short papers. One called Jesus is Flatter Than a Pancake, which comes from of improbable research, which is, it's a funny type of journal. But it's based on science. It's based on scientific principles. It's written like a scientific paper. And it's actually, there is an experiment in there. It's a lot of nice research there. Funny problems solved in funny ways. That's what they've done here as well. They've measured a pancake and they've measured the state of Kansas in different ways or in a certain way. They've operationalized it in a certain way. So what you are to do then is to identify independent and dependent variables in these papers. It can be a bit challenging in the first one. A lot will do mistakes here, but you will be able to rewrite them. So deliver it, but you will be given the opportunity to write it again. So I'll come up with the right answers at that Tuesday, I think. So then we will discuss this. Identify independent and dependent variable. What terms are optimized and how? Or maybe they have done other operationalizations. Are there other terms here that which they should have been better at operationalizing? And are we dealing with reliable and valid conclusions? So that's what you are to do. But there is a second paper as well, which is a short journal paper or a conference paper we wrote based on a study we did here at in Gjøvik, maybe now it's even 10 years or something, where we checked computer users and non-computer users in a classroom and how that affected their, how they followed the lectures and how disturbed they were and so on. A relatively short paper, and you are to read both these papers and write this short, maximum 3-page thing based on this. You're not; it's a accepted, not accepted thing. You will get feedback and comments on it if it's not accepted. Or you will get some comments anyway. There will be a folder, as I said, a hand-in folder in Blackboard for this. There is an other assignment later, individual hand-in like this, which we'll come back to later. So, pretty straightforward. But don't worry, if you do mistakes, this won't stop you to do the exam. It's a work you need to do, and it's a way for us to check that you have some of these basic terminologies in, because it's ways you should use, methods you should use anyway when you try to read scientific papers. You should try be able to identify the variables, say something about or judge how operationalizations have been done, how good are the variables described, and you should be able to say something about or think about reliability and validity of the conclusions. So that's the first assignment. I told you I was going to start up one more thing. Because I will also, you are also going to do individual projects, or no, sorry, group projects here. I will make a sign-up sheet for this in Blackboard one of the days, where you can sign on, talk with some of your friends, and sign on to the same group. It's up to you to organize these groups. It's nice if you can do it across different disciplines, for instance, from different study programs. What I want you to do in this group project, and let me say right away for the streaming, there will be an alternative project for off-campus students who can't be here. It's nice if people who can be here, I think it's much relevant this study for them, and what I want you to do is to gather some data for us that we are going to use in some kind of a hypothesis testing thing. You should gather data of different types. We'll talk more about this when the groups talk with me, and we're going to do some statistical analysis of this data in a tool with me. So we need to discuss the structure of data structures and so on. What you are going to do is to find a research question that could lead to a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a best guess about an outcome, a relationship between variables. You should have a small discussion on this and then make an appointment with me, and then we can sit face to face and discuss this. And then we will go back to more details on how to do this as well. We should together then analyze or suggest a way to gather data. It can be observations, it can be questionnaires, it can be experiments, it can be measurements of different kinds. And then afterwards we will then do the data analysis and hypothesis testing together. And you will make a presentation based on this, which you should prepare in a way that allows you to present it here in the lecture. What types of project, you might ask? Yes. You need to take your own topic, but I have suggestions if you aren't able to come up with one. But the type of topic here can be, the important thing is that it's doable and that it creates data that allows us to do data analysis. And what we need then is data of a specific kind. We need some continuous data. We need something that varies a bit. That's not just yes and no, but that maybe is on a 10-point scale or is a measurement that goes a long way. Right, that's type of continuous data. And we need categorical data, like gender or group one and group two, or something else. So we should, for instance, a somewhat relevant topic that a group did a few years ago, which came out quite nicely. It was, applied computers group. Who had access to some nice instruments to measure color quality, color temperatures, and color measure color. Then I'm not sure what type of instrument it is. Spectrometer in Norwegian. And they stated that the grass is. They took a common saying. I'm not. It goes for all culture, but it says something that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. It's a saying. You want to go for something else. It's always better somewhere else. And I took this very concretely and used this color spectrometer and measured color on two sides of a fence. And made conclusions based on that. It gave us very nice data, and we had an independent variable that was on this side of the fence and the other side of the fence. of course, that needed a bit more operationalization. But again, they could practice a little bit this relevant instrument for them and some relevant terminologies. But it can also be highly relevant if you want to do something fun. It's a bit up to you. Should be ethical, so don't test a saying like the cat or hand on its feet, for instance. It could be a bit. But there is always groups that tests the saying that the butter side always ends up down when the bread falls from the table, for instance. But it could also be, I know information groups have made honeypots or honey traps to allure people to try to hack them, for instance, with relevant data that they used in another project. So it could be stuff like that, which is highly relevant. So it's a bit up to you to discuss this, but it's usually it could be a good idea to take one of these, take something that's taken for granted in the area or whatever, and try to challenge that in a funny way. So maybe it's a good, maybe you can get some inspiration from the one of the papers here as well, the one saying that Kansas is flatter than a pancake, at least from the journal where that is written. You can find that on the net as well, Journal of Improbable Research. Okay? Then I think we meet in 2 weeks' time. I think so. Watch the timetable. Okay, have a nice evening.